Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future. If you can't say it, you can't do it.
Welcome to Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I'm your host. My name is Franz. Well, it looks like the summer sailing schedule's filled up now. All crews are filled, so anybody wanting to ride in and possibly trying to join me this summer, sorry, don't bother. Looks like Jack and Neil are going to be joining me on my last crew, and I have the previous two crews filled. I've got my tickets bought. Hey, I checked out trying to get a decent flight over to Istanbul. And what I finally ended up doing was flying directly from San Francisco to Bodrum. Interestingly enough, it was much cheaper for me to fly all the way to Bodrum rather than going to Istanbul. So the flight goes from San Francisco to Istanbul, and then I change planes in Istanbul and go from Istanbul down to Bodrum, the airport at Bodrum. And that was about $500 cheaper than flying just from San Francisco to Istanbul. So I get the flight down to where I need to go for free, or actually they're paying me to take that flight. So I had to buy another ticket to get from Salt Lake down to San Francisco. But it turned out Turkish Airlines was by far the least expensive alternative for me. For some reason, Delta has raised its tickets. Ticket price from last year was around $1,200 round trip from Salt Lake to Istanbul. This year, it seems to be around $1,600 to $1,700, in spite of the fact that their fuel prices have gone down by about 50%. You figure it out. Maybe that's why the airline stocks have been doing fairly well. I got an email from Peter. Peter just went on a course to get his ASA 104. He took his sons with him. They had a great time. He was actually surprised that his children enjoyed it as much as he did. So he said, I'm looking to go on and getting some other certifications. Also, he volunteered to write a review for the ASA 103, and he's done that, and I appreciate that, Peter. I had lunch a couple weeks ago with my friend Rick. Rick's an attorney here in Salt Lake, and he's actually sailed with me quite a few years ago. In fact, he was with me when I had a miserable night in Mykonos years and years ago. I've told that story, I think, in the past. And also, he came back a few years ago and brought his father to go sailing. So he sailed with me a couple times. He's a client, and we got together for lunch to review his portfolio a couple weeks ago, and we were sitting there talking, and he's approaching retirement. And he said, geez, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I don't want to be hanging around my wife all day long, and she sure as heck doesn't want me to be hanging around the house either. So he said, I don't know what I'll do. Maybe I'll just keep working as a lawyer, and just at least so I have a place to go to get out of the house. And I made the comment, when we first launched our boat, we kept it in Oak Harbor, Washington. And Oak Harbor, Washington is right next to the Whidbey Naval Air Station. So it's a sort of a military town. And our boat was way, way out on the very, very end of the dock, about as far out as you can get in this marina. And so when we'd go up there, we had to walk by all these other boats. And off to our left, as we were walking out to the dock, was a lot of power boats that were actually covered. They had covered slips, which is nice. Keeps the bird droppings off. And we noticed as we'd walk out that there were always these men, these retired men, working on their boats and getting off their boats and walking down to another boat and getting on another boat and having cups of coffee together and just chatting. And my wife made the observation, I thought it was an accurate observation, and she said, you know what, these are just their tree houses. This is just their tree house. This is a way to get away from the wife and get out and sit on the boat all day long instead of hanging around the house. And I thought, well, that's absolutely right. It's absolutely right. When I travel in other countries, I'll notice that old men are sitting at cafes. I notice this in Turkey. I notice this in Greece. I notice this in Italy. It's a cultural thing. They'll just get together. They may play some cards. They may play some dominoes. They may play backgammon. Or they may not do anything. They may just sit there, chat, have a cup of coffee, and watch time go by. Watch the people on the streets. But they do have some sort of a social outlet. In America, we really don't have that. We really don't have it. You may belong to a club, but there's no place that American men go just to hang out. That's sort of a sad commentary that women tend to have these social groups, but men in America don't. Anyway, Rick was saying, hey, you know, I just read a really good book, and you should read it. And it's called Travels with Epicurus. It's by Daniel Klein. So I went to the library and I picked it up. And here's what it says. Travels with Epicurus, a journey to a Greek island in search of a fulfilled life. Haven't got through the whole thing yet. It's not a very big book, but I've been pretty busy lately. But I did want to share one little passage from this book that I thought was really interesting. And he's talking about traveling around the Peloponnese with his wife and daughter. And I'm just going to read from the book for a couple pages. Hope you enjoy it. On one of my many returns to Greece, I rode the trains around the perimeter of the Peloponnese with my wife and daughter. And Greece, after failing to qualify for entry into the euro as currency in 1999, was trying again. My wife, who is from Holland, surveyed the scene outside our window with a sardonic eye, spotting inefficiencies everywhere. "Look at them," she would howl as we passed a group of five Greeks leisurely unloading a cartload of eggplants, bucket brigade style, several with cigarettes dangling from their lips. "These people aren't serious about the euro." Although she was smiling, she was at least half serious. Holland, of course, is the world capital of Calvinism. My daughter and I soon assigned her the nickname the Euro Inspector. One morning after a magical few days in the northern Peloponnese village of Diakofto, we made our way to the railroad station to catch the train to Corinth. My grade school level Greek qualified me as our tour leader. I bought the tickets and found us seats on the departing train, where I immediately spread out my limbs and drifted into a pleasant snooze. Minutes later, I was woken by my wife. We were going in the wrong direction. We had gotten on the train circling the Peloponnesian Peninsula counterclockwise instead of the one circling it clockwise. My wife realized this when our train passed a bench holding the same three old men we had passed when we'd come from the other direction a few days before. "It's as if they never move," she said. My whimsical daughter chimed in that we must be on a time-traveling train, and we're rolling back into the past. Indeed. Clearly, it was my responsibility to rectify the situation. I found the conductor seated at the front of the car, where he was drinking coffee from an espresso-sized ceramic cup. I learned later that when he wanted more coffee, he simply exchanged this cup for a full one proffered through the windows by waiters from the various railway station cafes along the way. I wished the conductor a good morning, and he immediately urged me to sit down across from him, begging my pardon for not being able to offer me some coffee. I told him about my train mix-up. He laughed and said in English, "This happens all the time. You only had a 50-50 chance of getting on the right one." But for the next few minutes, that subject had to wait for more significant matters. Was I from New York? Possibly Queens, Astoria? Oh, from Massachusetts. Did I know the Manicus family in Boston? They came from the same village as his wife. During this genial schmooze, I kept my eye averted from my wife's urgent stare. After the conductor and I finally came to a satisfactory resolution of our round of Greek-American demography, I did know George Gennaris in Lenox, Massachusetts, whose father hailed from Patras. The conductor picked up a radio phone the size of a wooden shoe, pressed some buttons, and spoke a few words in rapid dialect that I suspect would have been unintelligible to a native Athenian, as it was to me. Smiling, he then instructed me to get my family and luggage prepared to disembark. We did as told. Several minutes later, our train came to a gentle stop beside an apricot grove. We now saw the train coming from the opposite direction and also stopped there. The passengers from that train had stepped outside and were lounging along the apricot trees Someone among them had produced a jug of yogurt drink that was being passed around. Some were smoking cigarettes. A few had picked ripe apricots and were munching on them. All were chatting amiably. Our conductor saluted his counterpart, gestured toward us, and bade us a warm farewell. Then we realized what had just happened. Hearing of our plight, the engineer of the oncoming train had brought it to a halt, and his passengers, apparently without complaint indeed, seemed to be taking pleasure in this unexpected intermission, had disembarked to wait for us. Personal schedules, if there had been any, evaporated. The train was definitely not going to be running on time. Talk about inefficiency. This would never have happened in Holland. My daughter and I turned to the Euro inspector and laughed so hard we could barely walk across the tracks. Recalling this episode now, I am convinced I have come to the right part of the world to meditate on the best way to live my old age. I thought that was pretty enlightening on the Greek culture in general, and it's similar to a certain extent of the Turkish culture as well. Anyway, thought I'd share that with you. I'm about 20 lessons into the ASA 104 exam series, Sailing Learn to Sail Lessons for the ASA 104 exam. It looks to me like there's going to be about another 5 to 10 lessons left to go, and I'm hoping to get this done before I go sailing this summer. It's taking a lot of time, a lot more time than I expected. I still only have 7 reviews on my ASA 101, and I gave out 33 review copies. I'm still looking for reviewers. If you're interested in giving me an honest review of the audio course, write me a note and I'll get you a code that will allow you to download it, but only if you promise to write a review. I'm not going to give a blanket code out again because I think a lot of people just took advantage of it and have no intention of writing a review. So that being as it is, I'll just have people that are actually willing to write a review, review it. If you'd like to purchase the ASA 101 or 103 courses that I've developed, these are audio courses and they're quite long. One's over 9 hours long, and I'm not sure how long the other one is, but it's even longer. They're available in iTunes and also on Amazon, and they're also available at the website. At the website, you would download individual MP3 files, and then from your computer, you would need to get those put into your audio device, whether it's an iPhone or iPad or whatever MP3 player you use, if you're using it in a mobile environment. Or just save it to a disc and play it in your CD in your car if it plays MP3 files. If you buy it in iTunes, it goes right into your iTunes directory. Amazon will be MP3 files as well. So anyway, I appreciate those that have purchased those. It's not a big seller. I'm not getting rich on them. It's not going to provide much for me in my old age. Maybe a cup of coffee at a Greek taverna once in a while. But so far, it's been an exercise of, I guess, charity to a certain extent right now. Hopefully that'll change. All right, with that out of the way, let's get on to my interview with Dave Anderson of the Sailing Podcast. I have the honor of talking to David Anderson of the Sailing Podcast today. Dave's down in Queensland, Australia, and he's been doing... How long have you been doing your podcast, David?
I actually had to go back and have a look to see when I got that first episode out, and it was the 1st of April 2012, so that's, 13, 14, 15, about 3 years ago.
Okay. I think you and I have been at it about the same length of time, and I just broke 50 episodes, and you are right there right now almost, aren't you?
Yeah. I've got number 50 ready. I'm just looking for a time to just, with each episode, I try and put out a web page to go with it. And I just got to find that time to sit down and type out that other web page for my episode number 50. Yeah, I find that works well because often during the podcast, we'll chat about a few different things and, especially like other links to other sort of resources, stuff like that. Usually the people I talk to have got their own website, so I'll link to them as well. So it lets people sort of connect, which I think is the aim of the game in the end, is to sort of share all those stories.
That's the point. Tell me a little bit about yourself. You are a sailor right now, is that right?
Yeah. Well, I've got a boat, but I actually went sailing yesterday. I'm really excited. I'm in a good mood today because I went sailing yesterday and I'm sort of moving chronically in the wrong order. But I've got a – well, I've got a Warham, and it's a 42-foot Warham. It's like an ocean-going boat, but it's sitting in the Noosa River on a mooring at the moment. And I was getting really frustrated because I wasn't getting much sailing in. And so I went and bought actually an off-the-beach catamaran just a couple of weeks ago. And so I had fun yesterday. I took Karina out. Karina's my wife. And we took this little, 14, 15-foot catamaran out for a sail. We've got a lovely lake just near where we live. And so I got to have a sail yesterday. So I'm really excited.
I'm looking at this picture on your website, and it looks like a catamaran. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I bought that back in about 2007 with the intention of pretty much sailing off into the sunset straight away. But that plan actually fell over. And so it's been sort of just, so it's sort of a bit sad to talk about. I hope I don't sort of bring down the podcast, but it's been sad that I haven't gotten away. I mean, life's still gone on and we've done lots of good things and but the Warham's sitting there and I wish I was away sailing, but it's just not the right time in our lives at the moment. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. Sometimes you're ready, sometimes you're not. Tell me about how you learned to sail.
Well, I sort of, after I finished school, I hadn't done any sailing probably until, it would have been, let's see, about 2003 was probably when I first really got into sailing. Before that, Karina and I had been ski bums, basically, and we'd been working in Australia in the snow, and we'd been teaching in the States in the snow as well. And we did that for like 12 years, going back to back, doing winter in Australia, winter in the States. And then we finally decided to leave the ski industry. Our kids were then about 3 and 5, and we'd always sort of known that, you know, our goal was to get settled and give up skiing and let the kids go into school. So we did that, and that's when I said, well, I've finished skiing, so I want to start sailing. And it was just something I wanted to do.
Where do you ski in Australia? Tell me about the skiing in Australia. I've met, actually, skiing in Utah. I used to run into a lot of Aussie sailors, or not sailors, skiers, doing exactly what you were doing. So, which really surprises me because I don't think of Australia as a skiing country.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got just a few mountain ranges that just hit the snow level during the middle of winter. And Corinne and I were based at a resort called Mount Hotham. And that's in the state of Victoria, about like 4.5-5 hour drive from Melbourne. And there's also some resorts up in New South Wales around Mount Kosciuszko. There's probably 5 or 6 resorts there. And yeah, Australians are pretty keen skiers. I mean, you know, generally outdoorsy sort of culture. And we don't have terrific snow conditions. I mean, I really discovered that, I guess, once I started skiing in places like Utah and learning what powder snow was really like. But, we always still get out there and have a good time.
Have you always been a traveler?
I would say no. I'd say it's almost like, I don't know whether it's an intergenerational thing. Like, my parents were actually very sort of stable, homebody people. And so I grew up pretty much just doing things around. Like visiting the local family was sort of like a trips out. I mean, we did a few big holidays with my parents, but Karina was really the ingredient in my life. She's just left for work, so she doesn't get to hear all this praise I'll give her. But once Karina and I started going out, Karina had that real travel bug, and she really opened up the world for me and got me out and about and doing things. So that sort of changed my life. I guess getting married does that to somebody.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say you weren't, because I run into Aussies, Australians, I call them Aussies, all over the world. In fact, when I was sailing my boat along the coast of Spain, we wintered it over a 2-year period in Santa Pola, and we came back to put it in the water, and we were going to be sailing from a town called Alicante out to the Balearic Islands, out to Ibiza, Menorca, and Mallorca. Actually, it's Ibiza, Mallorca, and then Menorca. That's the order they're in. And anyway, there are a couple Australian girls, the women, college-age girls, sitting there at the dock, hitchhiking, trying to get a ride on a boat. And, right. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And if my boat had been a little larger, I would have said, hop on. But it was pretty small, and it's we already had a crew of three, and five would have been too many. But they were out there just bumming a ride, looking for a ride out to the islands on a sailboat. And I said, well, what have you been doing? They said, well, we flew into Barcelona, and we've walked down the coast. We've walked all the way from Barcelona down here. Now we're going to hitchhike out to the islands and wander around out there. And that's over a 100-mile walk that they did. So they were quite adventurous, and I was very impressed with that sense of adventure that they had. And that's what I've seen in a lot of Australians when I've run into them when I've been traveling. So I don't think it's unusual to take off and just go travel down in Australia.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know whether this is an Australian term, but having a gap year is sort of like a generally accepted practice in Australia. Are you familiar with that term?
I've never heard that before, no.
Right. So having a gap year, it's like taking a year off. So like lots of people will finish high school, they'll have applied, maybe go to university, and they might either straight away take a gap year and take a year off to go traveling, or they might do their first or second year of their university studies and then take a gap in their studies and just go and travel. You know, and that's a pretty standard practice for Australians, is to get out and have that big adventure for a year or so.
Oh, okay. But you never did that yourself, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, once Karina and I got married, we were 23 by then, and we actually went off and did, actually going to Mount Hotham to the snow was the start of our year of travel. And we went to the snow and just worked there. And then the rest of the year, we just went traveling around Australia. We actually drove in a very old Turana Holden car, and we drove across the Nullarbor Plain to Perth. You said you'd been to Perth, didn't mm-hmm. you?
Yeah.
So we did the trip to Perth, and then we decided that was such a boring drive, we couldn't go back across the Nullarbor. So we went north and drove right up the coast and around to Darwin, and back through the centre, back to get to Mount Hotham in time for the start of the next ski season. So we sort of did do that sort of that year travel thing. It was, like I say, it's just sort of like a generally accepted thing that you're going to go and have a year off travelling.
You know, one of my favourite books is a book by Bill Bryson called In a Sunburned Country. Have you ever read that book?
No, I haven't.
It's a very humorous account of Australia. He's an author that writes in a very humorous manner, at least from Americans' perspective. But he talks about Australia, and you had a prime minister that went swimming one day and never came back, didn't you? Something along those lines.
Yeah, that's right. He was out snorkeling or something, and never found. I don't think they even found a body or anything.
Yeah, and the rest of the world didn't even know about it for the most part. That's just wasn't on the radar, but. When you drove across Australia, was it just desert pretty much all the way across there?
Yeah, well, definitely just such. When you do the drive from we were leaving from Melbourne, where I grew up, and that's where Karina grew up as well. Just a little side piece of trivia, we both actually went to the same primary school, and so we figured we'd probably known each other since about grade two. And, we drove across from Melbourne, across to Adelaide, and then the stretch from Adelaide to Perth is just really desolate. But, I mean, it's beautiful. The desert's beautiful in itself, but, you know, it's just very remote. And, it was a pretty amazing trip, and it just makes you feel like you are on the other side of the world, even though you've just driven across the country. It's such a big country.
So were you following the coast across there? Because I'm looking at the map as I'm talking to you. Looks like there's the A1 that goes pretty much all the way across there. Is that the road you took then?
Yeah. And you're sort of going to stretch my memory if you ask me too many questions about that trip. It was a long time ago now. But we had the car, we had the trailer. We were both into surfing then, so we sort of had our surfboards with us. And some off that road, we'd sort of duck in every now and again and head to the coast where there was a little spot to go surfing. We're not sort of really good surfers, but we had our surfboards and we go for a splash whenever we got a chance.
I was reading your little bio about yourselves on your website, and you run a little business there in Noosa Head. Tell us about it. Noosa Holiday Homes. What is that?
Yeah, yeah. So we've got our own. We've got actually quite a nice house. I'm sitting at home at the moment and sort of looking over the ocean, watching a boat go past, watching a couple of surfers out in the waves there. And we bought a house up in Queensland when our first son was born. So that would have been 1997. Or we bought a block of land. We built a house, and I sort of owner built that house, and then we kept that for maybe 7 years, then we sold that, and then we bought this house that we're in now, which is sort of got a nicer view near the beach, and we actually holiday let the house out as well because it's in a really nice location. It's a big house, and so what we do is we sort of move out for stretches, and we'll rent something else, and then we'll rent our house out to people who are on holidays, and we sort of manage that all ourselves. Like sometimes people do it through a real estate agent. You're going to sort of we figure we're saving ourselves like the 10 or 12% commission that an agent gets. So it's sort of like a bit of an occupation to be self-managing the property. And we advertise it. Probably not a website you guys know there is Stays. It's an accommodation letting website. And then we've just started using Airbnb as well, which I think is more international. And, yeah, we just sort of rent the house out, helps pay off the mortgage. I mean, I say we own the house, but the bank owns a significant portion of it as well.
I'm looking at the Nosa Holiday Homes website. Is that the house you're talking about where all those great photographs are taken? You're looking out at the coast. You're looking out at some waves crashing in the beach. Is that the area we're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. So Nosa Holiday Homes website is our house, and just sort of it's just where I can send people to have a look at more photos if they send me an inquiry.
Okay. How have you been? Have you been renting it out a lot lately? The reason I ask, and this is kind of opportune, my partner just told me that he and his family are flying to Sydney in the next couple weeks. And I said, oh, where are you going to be going? He said, I'm not sure. I said, well, you might want to check out Airbnb because he's got himself, his wife, and three children. So they're not going to be renting a room. They're going to be looking for something a little larger. And is this the high season down there or the low season? What is it right now?
So I'd say we're heading into low season over the winter. We're busiest. Well, obviously when Australians have school holidays, we're really busy. And over Christmas, January and December are busy. We've actually been busy right through. Like we've got bookings at the house all the way through April this year, which is sort of a little bit unusual. And I guess it's maybe a reflection of the economy that people are starting to feel a bit more confident about spending money. It's been sort of like, you know, after the GFC, we sort of saw a downturn in business. And I think that's just because people were being a lot more careful with their money. Maybe a lot of people got burnt and lost some of their investment savings. And but we're seeing it pick up now, although the original question is, what is it now? We're heading into winter, which is actually the nicest time to be up where we live because it's still nice and warm all through the winter. It's a quieter time of year for us.
Well, let's get back to sailing. And I've been looking at your list of interviews and podcasts that you've done over a while. Tell me about some of your most interesting memories of the people you've talked to and what you've learned from them.
That's a deep question. I'll just start by saying that, you know, when I started, you know, I'd been listening myself to the Furled Sales podcast, which ran for quite a long time. Have you listened to some of the Furled Sales episodes?
I'm not sure. I listened to one that's no longer being made. It was like the final podcast as he was sailing in different areas. And I think he was heading back to Australia. I think that was where he was from. And he said, this is going to be my final podcast. And that was that. But no, I don't think I've listened to any of his podcasts. So give us a heads up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, podcast. Anyway, the Furled Sail podcast, I think the guys were down in Florida, Noel and Kirsty, I think. Christy it was. Anyway, so they did this, and my podcast follows very similar in the way that that it works. But what I was saying to start with is I'd been listening to their podcast, and they actually stopped podcasting after doing it for quite a long time. I'm sure they've got over 100 episodes there. And I just had this really real burning interest in sailing, and I thought, oh, well, I'd like to try and do that. And So I sort of followed the same pattern they were doing. I started by interviewing a few people who were local in my area, which made it a little bit easier to get started. So the first few episodes I did were sort of more face-to-face interviews. And from there I grew into just from following things online and seeing different people. It's like a big web, you know. I mean, the internet is a big web of connections to different people. And over time I've just sort of gone around and looked for interesting stories, focusing mainly on the cruising sailor side of things. And that really interests me more than the racing side of sailing. And I think it's just really interesting to hear people's stories of travels and places they've been. And so I've tried to get a really broad range of interviews with different sailors. And actually the first couple of episodes I did were with a guy called Alan Breckel, who lived locally with me. And I actually had been sort of, when I got into sailing, just as a side story, I started by I wanted to go and do some blue water sailing. So I joined a website called Find a Crew, and that's for people who are looking for somebody to come and crew for them. And I sort of connected with this guy Alan, and he was sailing his boat back from Auckland back to Brisbane. So I chatted to him, and I flew over to Auckland and actually got to do a sail across the Tasman Sea with Alan. And he ended up being my first guest when I did the podcast, because he had a really big background in sailing. So that was a good start off there. And then from there I went on to interview Kylie, who runs the Find a Crew website. So it was sort of interesting how one thing led to another. And, it's just gone on from there. I'm just looking through my own list of people here, and, everybody has different story. I think that's the bottom line, is everybody does have a story, not just celebrities. Do you know what I mean? I've really found, the thing I've learned is that, you know, everybody's got a really interesting story. I mean, especially I'm focusing on sailing things, but I just feel that if you sit down and really start talking to somebody, you can learn so much, and it's just a nice thing to do. I just really enjoy listening to what people have to say and what their life is like.
You have a good style of interviewing too. You ask open-end questions and let people run with them, I've noticed in your podcasts.
Well, I think I'm a good listener. I actually have to tell you that I was anxious about talking to you and being on the other side of the microphone and being interviewed, because I do tend to just sort of ask questions and sit there and listen to what people have to say. And I sort of was worried, oh, I'm going to be on the other way around. I hope I can put more than two sentences together for Franz, because I think I'll run out of things to say.
We all worry about that. We all worry about that. Fortunately for us, we have editing at our hands before we have to put these out. That's the nice thing. So,
yeah, that's right.
When you let's talk about episode number 12, if I can just pick your memory, if you can remember. This is a conversation with Alan Breckel, and I have listeners that are asking for tips and techniques and ways to deal with just to learn more about sailing. And this was your episode where you talked about tips for heavy weather sailing. Do you recall much of that conversation with Alan?
Well, I remember we've sat down in his at his house. Again, Alan was the guy I'd sailed across from Auckland with, so I'd heard a lot of his stories. He had a really amazing background. And I can't say that I remember all the points that we talked about. I'd probably have to listen to it again. And it sort of makes me sad to talk a little bit about Alan, because he actually died not that long ago. He had a motorcycle accident, and it was probably 2 years ago now. And so that was another sad sort of side note about having had those conversations. But you know what was really interesting is that his family actually contacted me, and they were really excited because I'd actually captured sort of a piece of his stories that they were able to hold on to, which was nice.
You know, that's happened to me one time with one of the people I interviewed as well, John Quinn, and he was a close friend and had sailed with me twice. And I interviewed him about when he was a young man hitchhiking around Europe, and this would have been back in the late 60s, early 70s. And he told me stories that I don't think his family had ever heard. And I keep the podcast up specifically because it's a way of keeping my friend John alive. Yeah, that's the way I sort of look at it. You know, his stories live on forever.
What were you going to ask me something about the heavy weather sailing tips that Alan talked about?
Yeah, what tips did he give you? Any specific tips? And on your sail up from, was it Tasmania, across the Tasmanian Sea, that's notorious for bad weather, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was where Alan had a really interesting backstory. He'd sailed a lot out of Auckland, and he was sort of telling me about, I mean, in New Zealand sailors are pretty hardcore. I mean, if it's not blowing over 30 knots, they're not all that motivated to go sailing. And, well, that's what I'm talking about, more the racing fraternity. But he's sort of been tripping back and forwards over his whole lifetime, back and forwards across the Tasman. And he actually had that experience where he'd been caught in one of those really bad storms. And I remember him telling me the story about that. And, I remember we talked about heaving to and sort of tactics like that when the weather got really bad. And, now I'm stretching my memory. I can't remember some of the other points that he made. But, you know, it's definitely a good episode. I remember it sort of gave some good tips, and it had quite a lot of people listen to it as well.
Okay, well, I'll make sure I give a link to your website in the show notes, and people can go and look at that and hopefully subscribe to your podcast as well. But if they need to go back and look for that, it may not be in the iTunes directory, but they can listen to it directly from your site. So when you sailed, now you sailed from, you said Auckland over to Sydney on his boat then?
Yeah, we went Auckland to Brisbane. So it was good because that's sort of fairly close to where I live. And Alan actually only lived down the road from me, like 20 minutes away. So it was sort of worked out really well for both of us that way.
So is that with the prevailing winds? It would be in the Southern Ocean, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we were sort of sailing with the trade winds coming back. It's probably a much harder trip going the other direction from Brisbane to Auckland. And he told me about doing that trip, he often has to sail down the coast, sail down south, so that he can then – he was sailing from Brisbane, he'd head south, and then he'd go across – so he could try and reach across towards Lord Howe Island and then make for the tip of New Zealand to go up and around the northern tip of New Zealand to get back down into Auckland. But we had a very, 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 I'd say almost boring trip over where we just sort of had, you know, maybe 10 knots of wind and a couple of days without very much wind at all and the motor running, which is a bit annoying, but... Yeah, so we had a very sedate trip. There were no really good stories that came out of the trip itself, but it was a wonderful experience. Just I loved just being out. It was sort of my first experience of being out of sight of land for days on end and, you know, just being able to sit there and just watch the swell and the waves go past. It was just a wonderful experience.
Those are the sort of days we dream about, but our best stories come from our most uncomfortable experiences.
Yeah, that's right. There's probably not much I can sort of bring back out of that trip that was sort of amazing or really super interesting. We just had the sails up, excuse me, and we just, you know, potted across the ocean, and it was terrific. I mean, I loved being in the big swells of the ocean. I really enjoyed the sensation of sailing along with the swells, and probably the only funny incident that happened on the way there is I was sitting out, like we had the it was a monohull. We spent most of the time just in the cockpit. But because it was so nice, I'd just go up and sit on the bow of the boat. I liked sort of being out in the front of the bow. You get a little bit more motion while you're sailing along. And Alan didn't come out there very often. He was probably already close to 70 at that stage. But he did come up one afternoon, and he sat there with me. He goes, I'm really surprised. We just haven't seen any dolphins on this trip. And I swear, 30 seconds later, this massive school of like 100 dolphins came and just swam around us and swam past. It was so funny.
So you were there at the right time, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You've interviewed Paul and Cheryl Shard several times, it looks like.
Yeah, I've had a really nice relationship with the Shards. I mean, I think they're used to being presenters as well. They've sort of spent a lifetime sailing and documenting their trips. And sort of we got in touch, and I did an interview with them about their backstory, and then got to know them a little bit better, and I saw that they were doing lots of seminars, sailing seminars, and also that they would put out lots of how-to sort of videos as well. So then I chatted to them and said, if you'd like to come back, I'd love to have you back on the show, and we can sort of dig into some different topics at the same time. So they've been really, really nice. I had one episode where people just sent in some questions and we did some rapid fire questions with them. And actually, just before you and I started chatting, one of the most recent episodes I did with them was how to earn money while cruising. And that's actually been, or it was called Make Money While Cruising. And that was a very popular episode. I was just having a look before we started talking, and it's had nearly 10,000 downloads. So I think that's pretty amazing. So it was good to chat to them. And yeah, just because they've met so many different people while sailing. So it's not like they're actually good because they don't just talk about themselves. They share stories about other people that they've met cruising, and they've got a really broad range of experiences to share. And yeah, and I like Cheryl's voice as well. She's got a very nice speaking voice. I just did an interview with Eve Gelinas, who does the Cape Horn Wind Vane. Have you heard of him?
No, I haven't. So you haven't posted that one yet, have you?
No, I haven't posted that one. I just actually talked to him maybe a week ago. And yeah, but it took me four attempts just to get a good connection so that we could get our interview done. And that's, I guess that's always part of the challenge of podcasting and interviewing people is getting a good connection. And especially I don't know how you've been, but when I'm calling people who are traveling like the Shards, I mean, I'm waiting for them to get into a port perhaps where they've got good Wi-Fi connection that we can have a sort of an episode or have an interview that sort of what's the word for listenable, that's not too garbled because of the internet connections. I had another guy I've chatted to a couple of times is Jack Binder, and he's got a really interesting story. They've got a website, Jack and Jude. I think it's jackandjude.com.au. I might be wrong. But they're down in Tasmania sailing at the moment, and Jack had some other things that we were going to talk about. He's just brought out another book, and he did this really interesting trip where they sailed out looking for a wreck out in the Coral Sea. So we talked on the phone about doing an interview, but again, I've lost track of him because they're sailing and he's only got his mobile phone, and so they're having trouble finding internet connections. So just a little bit of the backstory there, maybe some of the challenges of podcasting. I mean, it's great when it all works and you've got the technology on your side, but it can be a real challenge staying in contact with people as well and lining up those interviews. I mean, you and I are now dealing with different time zones as well, which is another challenge. I don't know whether you find that as much of a challenge as I do, but I'm 18 hours or something different to you. So I've always got to sort of, when I was calling Eve, he was in Quebec. So I had to work out a time to call him. It ended up being to call him at, I think, 9:30 in the morning. I had to ring him at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night to do the interview.
Oh, yeah. You know, that is a problem. You could be, what, up to 12 hours in difference. And you're pretty darn close to that here. As I recall, Perth was almost exactly on the opposite side of the earth when our daughter lived there. And you're even worse. And when I fly over to the Mediterranean, between Utah and the Mediterranean, that's 9 hours of difference. So, yeah, dealing with the time difference is difficult, especially since I'm not an early morning person. In the morning, I like to do other things. I like to do you. Fortunately for me, you set this up so it's late in the afternoon my time, and it's early in the morning your time for this podcast today.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I'm the opposite way around. I'd much rather talk to people in the morning because I find I'm a little bit tired out by the end of the day, and I sort of had to have a coffee at 10 o'clock at night just to make sure I was fired up when I was talking to Eve, just to make sure I didn't sound too boring. I guess that's always the thing as well. I want to sound interested when I'm interviewing people, so I tend to avoid the end of the day. I feel like people might detect it in my voice that I'm a bit tired.
So what are your plans in the foreseeable future for sailing? Are you going to put off cruising for a while, or what are your plans? What are you looking forward to doing?
Yeah, I'll go back a step. I sort of told you a little bit about my boat. It's got a little bit of an interesting backstory. It's a Warham catamaran, and it was actually built in England, and I picked it up in Vanuatu, which is not that far from Australia. I don't know, have you guys actually had much of the story about the Vanuatu cyclone that just happened recently?
I haven't seen it in the news that much, but I went on and watched some of the videos in YouTube on it.
Right, yeah, they just had a devastating, like, Category 5 cyclone go right through Port Vila, which is where I actually picked my boat up. So it's been very real in my mind to imagine the devastation there. But the people who had my boat, or do I have their boat? I don't know which way around I should be saying it. They actually built the boat in England because a lot of Warhams are owner-built. And they built it in England. They actually sailed this Warham across the Atlantic. They've been down through the intercoastal waterway, you know, through all the Bahamas or whatever's down below Florida, the Caribbean, through the Panama Canal. And then they sailed across the South Pacific. And they got as far as Vanuatu and for whatever reason decided that was probably the end of their – they were, I think, also into their 70s by that stage. So it's a big boat to be handling. And, yeah, I picked the boat up. That was 2007, and I sailed it back across from Vanuatu with a couple of my friends. We sailed back across. We went through New Caledonia on the way, stopped in there, and then sailed back across and checked in at Bundaberg, which is one of the ports of entry just north of where I am, and then sailed the boat back down here to Noosa. And that was 2007. So like I say, I sort of really had that plan at that stage. I'd just been selling a childcare center that I owned, and I was hoping that that would sort of free up enough cash to sort of get out and start doing some sailing. But the timing was right into the GFC. So I don't know how much it affected – well, it must have affected people in America because that's where a lot of it came from. But yeah, I think what I'm trying to say is you sort of get the feel that was sort of really a bad timing. I think I was made the mistake myself. I was basing my plans on – what was really good economic conditions at the time, and then things really fell off the cliff. And same in Australia. It really slowed down the economy here. So I've had to sit on my hands ever since then, waiting for the economy to sort of improve a little bit. So like the original question was, what's my plan now? Well, I've had to sort of rejuggle around plans, and I think I'm working now on more like a 5-year plan because I've got a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old. So the 18-year-old's good; he's pretty independent now, goes to university. But the 15-year-old's got 3 more years of high school, and then hopefully we'll get him to go into university and get him established. So that to me looks like about a 5-year plan now, and so that's what I'm talking to Karina about. Is, you know, maybe we can look at that as a more realistic time to head off and start having our sailing adventure. So that's what the plan is at the moment.
Okay, well, yeah, you've got some high expense years coming up for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, I hope they don't get more expensive than what they are now. I think you're right though. It's really a part of your life where you're sort of supporting your kids and you're paying money for schooling and things like that. So it's been a bit of a muddle up. I don't know whether I told you either, but Karina's been quite unwell recently. Did I mention that to you, in our previous conversation?
You mentioned that to me in our last conversation. It was the a pharmaceutical product that she – or not a pharmaceutical, a medical device that's caused her a lot of problems, hasn't it?
Yeah,
Let me turn off my phone just a second here. But, yeah, she's had some bad medical problems from, was it a vaginal mesh? Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was. That's right. It was that sort of product. So tossed into all the mix of, you know, life's just like that, isn't it? I mean, I guess at the end of the day, life comes along and things change. You can never plan too far ahead, but I guess I still think it's realistic, a 5-year plan. I actually think it's going to become a bit of an interesting topic on my podcast, that concept of planning. There's a couple of people I've talked to because, I mean, the other nice thing about podcasting is I get lots of emails from people, you know, often just saying, hey, I'm enjoying the podcast, having a listen, this is where I live, this is what I'm doing. Or if people don't tell me what they're doing, I'll write back and say, look, tell me where you are and where you're in your sailing sort of life. And I've heard quite a few stories. I think a lot of my audience are people who are planning to go sailing. So I keep that in mind when I'm interviewing as well, is that it's a lot of people who are thinking a few years ahead to start their sailing journey. And I've chatted to people by email who've actually had really concrete 5-year plans. And I've got a couple of them on my list to really sit down and talk to how they've structured a plan like that, because I'm sort of in that stage now where I'd like to sort of even try and – I'm not maybe a very good planner. Maybe that's one of my problems, but I'd like to sit down and get somebody to show me how they lay out like a plan to go sailing as far as sort of being able to start budgeting and putting money away over time. So you've got like a cruising kitty saved up and things like that. So I don't know, have you sort of had crossed paths with people who are planning that far ahead?
I cross paths with people like that. I'm not sure if they ever really pull off the plans. You know, it's one of those things that for me, it was things sort of just developed. I mean, I knew what I always wanted to do, and I just worked towards that goal continuously. Sometimes you make progress, sometimes you didn't make progress, but eventually everything falls in place, and it always does somehow, some way. You know, I'm a big believer that if you want something bad enough, you're going to figure a way to get it. And that's worked for me for the most part. So my daughter always asked me, Dad, how do you budget? And I said, I just don't spend money, you know, unless it's on something important.
Yeah, it's very interesting you mentioned that, because you know, I talked to Paul and Cheryl Shard recently, which was about making money while you're cruising. And then I've got another interview I've actually done as well, which is with Lynn Pardy, because you know the Pardys a little bit.
I do, and when you anyway. Talk to them, ask them to get a hold of me, because I'd like to talk to them, and I actually personally know them, so that'd be good. I don't know, are they down in are they in New Zealand right now? That's where they live.
Yeah, that's right. They're at their home base now, and I've actually talked to Lynn already, but. You know, you were talking about how, you know, how do you sort of save money, and it has to do with not spending as much money. And Lynn's actually put out some videos that have to do with the sort of cost-conscious cruiser, and about sort of being really careful about where you're spending money cruising. And I talked to her about that during the interview, as well as hearing some of their backstory. I mean, yeah, I know who they are a little bit, but it was really interesting to hear about their travels and things. But they've got a lot of good advice about, well, you know, maybe you just need to question whether you need all those bits and pieces on your boat, and you know, are you trying to just sort of outfit a boat to keep up with the Joneses, or you know, is there a simpler way to get out sailing and keep down the cost that you've got to keep paying out? Well, it's like a penny saved is a penny earned. You know, if you can really work, I wanted to say work to a budget, but what I'm trying to say is if you can sort of structure yourself to get in the habit of sort of questioning when you're paying money out, that's money that you're saving at the same time, if you can reduce your expenditure.
Yeah, there's only really two ways, either reduce your expenditures or increase your income. And sometimes it's easier to reduce your expenditures. And the Pardys are just, I mean, they've been sailing around the world for years and years and years, living on, for the most part, what they've been able to make from their books and their presentations. And they've made a wonderful lifestyle out of, without really too much money, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, they sail a very, very small. What I wanted to say is they sail a very simple yacht. You know, they've spent most of their life sailing without a motor, which again is, it's going to save you money. And we talked a bit about the sort of marketing strategy of a lot of the advertisers who are trying to sell goods, sort of push the big boat concepts, and perhaps people need to show some self-control, I guess, and try and look through that marketing thing to say, well, do I really need the 50-foot lagoon catamaran to have a good sailing adventure? And at the end of the days, you don't. I mean, they've sailed happily, I think, on a 30-foot boat, and there's nothing wrong with that. I was talking yesterday to my friend Claude, who was one of my interviews I did really early on. Claude sailed from Quebec to Australia, I think, in an 18-foot Bruce Roberts design boat that he built himself as well, you know. And Claude says, you know, people don't realize that there's been just thousands of trips in these smaller sized boats that have been 100% successful, and they haven't made the big headlines. They haven't had these catastrophic events happen. They've been built by sailors who keep very simple systems, a small boat, and they've had a wonderful journey circumnavigating or sailing across the oceans.
Yeah, and the party boat is by the same designer that my boat is, Lyle Hess, and their boat's maybe a foot longer on deck than mine. Of course, Larry built the boat himself. It's a wooden boat, and he's a true craftsman, a true wooden boat craftsman. And he designed the self-steering gear that I basically copied and use on my boat. So he's, you know, he's a true craftsman, and that's part of the way they save money, is they build instead of buy. You know, they just go and build what they'd need instead of buying it brand new. So it's, you know, it'll be interesting to hear you talk to them. I look forward to listening to it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to Lynn. I think that we sort of, I don't know whether she has this effect with everybody, but I really felt a good connection to her. I liked her philosophies on sailing and on sort of living a simple life, things like that. And the most interesting thing during the conversation, we were talking about how much sailing they'd done, and she said, "Oh, but I don't think I'm an expert." And I pulled her up at the end of the interview. I go, "Lynn, I think with all the experience you've had, you probably could call yourself an expert." Considering I think they've done over 200,000 miles of sailing.
Yes, I think the last time I saw Larry and Lynn, they were in Salt Lake visiting Larry's brother, Marsh, and that was probably at least 15 years ago. So I haven't talked to him in quite a while. But that was when I was building my boat, and so they came up and took a look at the boat in my backyard. And yeah, so it would have been over 15 years ago. So it's been quite a while. But anyway, say hello to her for me when you talk to her.
And yeah, shall do. And if anybody's looking to track them down, if they're listening and wondering where is an easy place to find them, they actually use Facebook. Lynn pops up on Facebook. I sort of connected with her there. I think if you just type Lynn Pardy in, you'll be able to see that she puts a few updates about what they're up to at the moment on Facebook.
Oh, okay, great. So your plans are just get through the next few years, get your boat in shape. Where do you want to go sailing? What are your goals and your ultimate sailing destinations?
Do you know, I would like to circumnavigate. That's really on the top of my list. And that comes from, you know, you were asking me earlier how I got into sailing. And I think really it goes back to I read a lot of sailing books, and I really enjoyed reading, and one of the books that I really got into, it's called A Voyage for Mad Men. Have you ever heard of that story before?
I have not read that book or heard of it.
Okay, so it's written by an author. I pulled it out because I was hoping I'd get a chance to mention it. It's called A Voyage for Mad Men. It's by an author called Peter Nichols, and I read this book, I can't tell you when, it was probably either before I even bought a boat or just after, but it was about the Golden Globe race that they had, which I think was like 1969, where they all took off to have that solo circumnavigation race that Robin Knox Johnson won.
Yeah, the original round-the-world, single-handed round-the-world race.
Yeah. So it sort of is a really good book that summarizes everything that happened during that trip. And then a lot of the sailors actually wrote their own books about the story, like Knox Johnson has his own book. And, you know, Bernard Moitessier was sailing in that and didn't finish the race, continued on, and he wrote a book. And so I then went on to collect all the books from the sailors who were in that. So I really have followed on with that onto buying lots of solo sailing books, you know, and I really enjoyed the stories of circumnavigation. So I'd put that as something I'd really like to do. I think it'd just be cool to go right around a little blue planet, and sail the whole way around. Unfortunately, you know, initially I'd thought that we'd be able to go through the Red Sea, you know, because from Australia you basically head north, go through you know, Southeast Asia, across to India. Then the old route was to head up through the Red Sea and into the Mediterranean. Well, it looks like, and from people I've talked to, that's sort of off the cards at the moment. I did hear one group that just went through not that long ago. One group that I follow did sail up through the Red Sea. But most people are now heading down south and heading down under the Cape of Good Hope. So, yeah, that'd be the way to go. I think that would be really exciting.
Yeah, and then it'd be hard to get back to Europe, so you'd almost have to avoid all of the Mediterranean if you do that. Unless you go to Brazil and then back to, from Brazil you'd catch the North Current and go up to, that'd be a long trip, but it might be an adventurous trip. That'd be worth doing, so.
Yeah, I've heard a few people heading straight across to Brazil and then work their way up to the Caribbean and then sail back across to Europe from there.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. This is always something I'm curious about. You're on a mooring in the is it the Noosa River, right? Is that how you
say
it?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And I'm looking at it. Is it a mooring you laid yourself, or is it a public mooring that you have to pay for, or how does it work there?
Yeah. So where we live in Queensland, I'm trying to think of what the name of the government body is. Anyway, there's a government body, the Maritime something, who regulate all the moorings. So you're not actually allowed to lay moorings without their permission. So luckily, many, many years ago, probably 20 years ago, I put my name on some waiting list for a mooring. And you sort of just have to wait and wait and wait. So for a long time, when I first got Seren into the river, so like I say, that was about 2007, it was just on anchor. And we get some, even though we're not sort of in the cyclone belt here, we get some nasty storms come through during summer, and I've had to rescue it off the beach a couple of times. And then finally my name came up to get permission for a mooring, and then I had to pay for a private company. I think it cost me like $1,200, $1,300, and they came and put a concrete mooring in for me where the boat is now, and that lets me sleep a lot better at night than I ever used to during the summer storms, I can tell you that.
Do you have to pay something annually to the government for that privilege?
It's actually really cheap at the moment. We shouldn't really be publicizing it, because if the government as soon as the government notices there's something they're not charging enough for, I'm just joking, but you know, some pencil pusher will go, oh, I know how we can raise extra revenue. But I think I pay the mooring, it's only like $50 a year or something, so it's a really good deal.
So if a vagrant sailor, an itinerant sailor, or what do we call them? Anyway, a cruising sailor comes in, is there plenty of mooring areas in your neck of the woods? Can people winter their boats in Noosa River? Or it looks like there's plenty of protection in that area.
So there are quite a few people who sort of winter their boats, or summer their boats perhaps is more likely, because this is a nice coast to cruise during the winter. So it's sailing season is really from May through to October, just to cruising around on the coast again, because during the summer it's a bit tropical, so we're getting storms and not so nice weather, and the risk of cyclones if you head north of Noosa. But the Noosa River itself, to start with, is very shallow. It's got a tidal bar. One of my episodes is actually about crossing bars, because we have a very active Coast Guard who have to go out and rescue people all the time. So keel boats won't come into the Noosa River because they can't get over the shallow bar, but there's lots of catamarans. So it's got a really good reputation, which again, we probably shouldn't be publicizing because it'll just make it get too busy. But it's got a nice place where you can anchor and leave your boat. You're not technically allowed to live on your boat while you're in the Noosa River. They're pretty strict on that, because it's also got a lot of sort of environmental protection on the river itself, which is really good. But people can bring their boats in and anchor them. Catamarans is what I was trying to say, and anchor them in the Noosa River. But not too far south of me is Mooloolabah Harbour, which is a deep water harbour. And so that's probably the more popular place to go, especially if you've got a keel boat. You can go in there, and there's marinas. There's no marinas. Well, there's one little marina in Noosa, but Mooloolabah is like a commercial port. It's got lots of fishing boats, lots of tour boats. It's got a big marina there. But it also has a small area where you can just anchor if you're passing through and stay there for a couple of days.
Well, Dave, I've really enjoyed talking to you. Have any other gems of advice to pass on before we close up the podcast?
Not really. I just invite people to come along and listen to the podcast, especially if they're into the cruising sailing side of things and they want to hear a few different perspectives. Occasionally I come up with an exciting trip that somebody's just finished, and I'll have a chat to them about what their trip's been like. The website's thesailingpodcast.com. You can find it on iTunes and sort of all the other podcatching places. One thing I've done recently is I host my media with a company called Libsyn, and they offer support by actually, you can pay a little bit extra, but get an app. So I've actually got people can also download a sailing podcast specific app to pop on their phone, which will let them get a notification. Actually, I don't know if the notifications are turned on, but it'll let them easily download the interviews so they can just have their phone with them and listen while they're on the move, maybe having a jog or traveling in the car. I think in the car is the main time I get to catch up with a few podcast episodes. Yeah, but that's it. And if anybody wants to contact me, it's david@thesailingpodcast.com.
I appreciate your time. Let's keep in touch, okay?
And can I also just mention, Franz, before you say goodbye, is that you've also just recently come on my podcast. So if people want to hear a bit more about your story as well, they'll find that episode's not up right at this minute, but perhaps by the time we both get our editing done, we'll have episodes up and people can come in. And I sort of asked you a bit about your background as well. If people would like to hear a bit more about how you got into sailing and things, they'll be able to catch that interview. And thanks for that.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it, Dave. Thanks for promoting me on your podcast, and I hope we both pick up some new listeners this way.
Yeah, well, I think we've got very similar audiences, and especially if we're only putting an episode out. I'm not sure how regular your schedule is, but mine's a bit haphazard at the moment. But I think between us, people will find something to listen to while they're doing their dog walk, or like I say, their gym workout, or driving to work one day.
Yeah, I'm trying to get more out because it just gets me in the habit, but I've just got to find people to interview. There are plenty of interesting people out there, so I just have to make the time to do it. So
Yeah, definitely. All right, great. Thanks, friends.
Thanks a lot.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening. If you have comments, drop me an email. If you're interested in purchasing any of my sailing courses, my audio sailing courses, I have audio courses for the ASA 103 exam and the ASA 101 exam. I'm currently working on the ASA 104 exam. The title is Sailing, Learn to Sail. Basic Keelboat Certification, lessons for the ASA 101 exam. And in the other one, it's Sailing, Learn to Sail, Basic Coastal Cruising, lessons for the ASA 103 exam. And you can also just search for my name, Franz Amason, in Amazon or iTunes if you're looking for those products. FranzAmusson. Thanks for listening. If you have comments, drop me an email.
Joe, do you have something to tell me?
No, I don't think so.
I just got off the telephone with Bill Rutherford. Princeton can use a guy like Joel.
What?
Princeton can use a guy like Joel. His exact words.
That's unbelievable.
You're as good as in. I knew you could do it. Haven't I been telling you, every once in a while, you just gotta say, what the heck, and take some chances.
You are so right.
You've made me very proud.
I was just thinking where we might be 10 years from now, you know?